Today we're doing a show about urine, and I know a lot of you are expecting some kind of cheap joke in this segment, but we just didn't think that was appropriate for public radio, so instead of my usual introduction, please enjoy this beautiful Bach cello concerto performed by Yo-Yo Ma. Now he spent 3 months in Alaska trying to write Finnegan's Wake in the snow. Colin McEnroe, man, I gotta go.
Actually, as we were sort of testing out those sounds for the intro, I had to go to the bathroom like 4 times. All right, so we are going to talk about urine today. Urine is in your life, right? You've already done it a few times today. You're going to do it a few more, but you probably don't think about it all that much unless you're the very kind of watchful, vigilant type who's, you know, always sort of checking out your pee, making sure it's an appropriate color, at least by your own lights. So we're going to try to answer as many of your questions as we possibly can today. Let me tell you a little bit about who's here. Part of this idea came from Maggie Downey. She's the owner of Personal Euphoria Pilates. She's been on our show before to talk about feet. She actually sort of sent us an email suggesting the basic idea for this show. We loved it right away. She's here. She has a lot of questions about urine, but she's also going to talk to you later about Kegels, which is, you know, sort of how you kind of tighten up those muscles. Also, a little bit later in the show, we'll be talking to Dinus Mickel. He's a Chicago native. He'll be on the phone with us from Vienna, Austria. He's a composer, entrepreneur, and health advocate. He, like thousands and possibly millions of people in the world, believes that drinking one's own urine is full of all kinds of healthful properties. So he'll be there. He'll be with us to explain all that. As I mentioned in the introduction earlier, among the people who've done this in the past was the Prime Minister of India, who shocked Dan Rather on 60 Minutes by explaining why he did this and why he thought it was full of health benefits and why many, many Indian people did it as well. And he lived to be 99, so, you know, take that for what it's worth. But we're going to start, you know, with kind of urine 101. We're gonna try to help you understand anything you might want to know about your urine. And with us to do that is Dr. Ryan Doran. He's a urologist from Hartford Healthcare. And first of all, welcome, Maggie, and welcome, Dr. Doran. And let's just sort of begin with what is pee? Let's imagine that I produce a sample, a specimen, and I haven't really done anything particularly odd today before that. I haven't eaten some strange food or some high concentration of something. I haven't taken any drugs. What is my urine going to be?
Well, first, Colin, thank you for having me on the show. Very glad to be able to talk about this over the air instead of just people one-on-one every day. So as far as your question, what is pee? Well, basically it's the product of what happens when your kidneys filter your blood. So blood flows to the kidneys. The kidneys have special cells lining their tubules that decide what to let through and what not to let through, and then it produces pee as the end result, which goes down into your bladder and then you pee it out. So on a normal day, when you've not done anything odd, anything strange, as you said, your pee is going to be mostly water, because the kidneys use the opportunity to remove any excess water that you might have. It's also going to contain multiple minerals, salts, like sodium. There might be a little bit of protein in there. There might be some sugar in there, though those should be very minimal. And then one of the biggest products in the pee is actually urea, which is an ammonia-based metabolic product, which if it builds up too much in your blood can cause serious problems like mental issues, delirium, things of that nature. So that's essentially it. And then also there's urochrome, which is just a fancy word for the coloring and pigment that makes it yellow.
And you know, the question then arises, how yellow should it be? And people do watch their pee pretty carefully. I do sometimes. I was just telling you before the show, I was on this bike trip in Europe, and there were some days where you know, it was pretty hot and we were sweating a lot and I was trying to hydrate, but I got back to my cabin on one day and my pee was like the color of Big Bird or maybe even more yellow than that, and like a Meyer lemon or something. And I was thinking, well, this doesn't look too good. I mean, how worried should you be about, you know, the sort of Sherwin-Williams fluctuations on the color chart of your pee?
Well, I say as long as it's some kind of yellow, usually you're in good shape, but you can use it to judge how dehydrated you might be. So when your pee was Big Bird colored, that likely meant you were pretty dehydrated, and what your kidneys are doing is they're retaining more of the water into your bloodstream rather than letting it filter through. So that urochrome, that pigment, really shines through more when you don't have as much water to dilute it. So we tell patients or anybody that you should be aiming for pretty clear pee or very light lemonade colored as far as your hydration is concerned. But as long as it's in the yellow spectrum, that's okay.
All right. Our number, by the way, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Now, you know, most of the time, RP is pretty much in somewhere in that yellow spectrum, and it's pretty much, you know, what we hope it would be, and we don't really think too much about it. But there are days when it's not. And first of all, there are days when it smells really odd or different. So can you talk a little bit about sort of some of the lifestyle choices that do affect what comes out of us?
Sure. Well, first on the color spectrum, concerning color, number one would be red. So if it's red, it could be blood in it, and that could be because of a cancer of your bladder, your kidney, prostate, urethra, you know, anything in the urinary tract. It could also be a symptom of other kidney disease, and you should definitely go see a urologist or your regular doctor to get checked out for that. Other colors, people have had blue pee, they get orange pee. They get sort of a purple pee sometimes. And all of these have to do with various medications people take, oftentimes for urinary issues that we prescribe.
There should be a huge warning on these medications because I'm telling you, if mine is blue, I'm fainting dead away.
Right, right. Yeah, and there should be. But luckily, you probably tell somebody if you saw it blue.
Oh, yes. I mean, when I woke back up, when I regained consciousness, I would tell somebody.
The one that does not have any warning label is Beets. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people who eat beets, actually 10% of the population will have red pee and even purple sometimes. And that can last for a day or so. And it can smell funny.
Well, speaking of smelling funny, we might as well just address some of the other sort of, I mean, let's go right to the asparagus thing. But now, I remember reading at some point, and I feel like the science section of the Times every 6 years comes out with a slightly different article about this. But I remember reading at one point that everybody's pee smells odd and perhaps unpleasant from asparagus, but not everybody has the capacity to smell that smell. You're nodding as though that might actually possibly be true.
Well, that's part of the debate, yes. Is it that? You know, is it only that 40% of us can smell it and have the proper receptors in our nose to detect that smell? Or is it that only 40% of us have a certain enzyme which breaks down the asparagus really quickly after you eat it into something that has this pungent odor? And, you know, medical science and government-funded research really hasn't focused on this, unfortunately.
we have a rover on Mars right now, but we don't know the answer to this basic question.
Priorities are all out of whack on this, Colin, I know. But we think it's probably a combination of both.
Yeah.
Not to hedge, but I'm hedging.
All right. Our number, if you have your own questions, this is Dr. Ryan Doran. He's a urologist from Hartford Healthcare, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Maggie Downey, I know some of your clients were hoping they could get some of their questions answered. So it's your turn.
All right, great. And thank you for having me on as well. The biggest question or the most common question that all my clients have for you is why do they have to pee at night? Why can't they make it through the night? And what's the difference in that urgency and need to pee at night that they don't experience during the day? Like during the day, they get the urge to pee, they have to go, but it's not pressing.
Well, try listening to fountain noises, by the way, for 20 minutes and see how urgent it feels. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, you know, that all depends on a lot of things about your clients. But, you know, if I had to make it the most simple explanation possible, I'm guessing they're not getting to the bathroom every 3 hours at night or routinely, and they're probably waking up 5 hours after they've gone to bed, perhaps, and then they have to go.
Yep.
So right there, they're storing up more urine than they were storing up during the day.
Right.
So when we start storing urine in the bladder, you know, at about, let's say, 30% full, your bladder sends a signal saying, I have to go. But it's not a strong one. 60% full, it sends a really strong signal, so you better get to the bathroom sometime soon. But you can suppress it. And at 90, and then when it gets just about full, then it's the you have to run and get there. So during the daytime, you're able to suppress these things as they come to prolong the amount of time between urinations as much as you need. At night, you're sleeping. You're not really thinking about this stuff. So your brain and your bladder are sort of on an autopilot where they have a routine. But once they get to a certain when it gets to a certain fullness, I think you're probably skipping those first two checkpoints. And then it's the you better go now checkpoint.
Right.
So that would explain part of it. The other thing is most of us have plenty to drink after dinner. And most of us, if we drink alcohol, occurs at dinner or after dinner. And alcohol has a direct effect on your kidneys that makes you make more and more urine. But you might not notice that till after you've gone to bed, and then you wake up and you really have to go. And the last reason for a lot of patients, or a lot of people in general, especially as we get older, we start to carry a lot of fluid in our legs as the day goes on because your veins aren't as good anymore at getting all that blood back to your heart, and the blood leaks out some water into your legs. When you lay down at night, most of us sleep laying down, that fluid will leach back into your circulatory system and then eventually gets to your kidneys and you make more urine. So some people actually make more urine at night than they do at day.
I think that very amply answers the question. But really for a lot of us, it's that middle thing that he mentioned, you know, which is notice how much you're drinking at night. If your nighttime ritual includes a big mug of sleepy time tea, guess what? It's going to be knocking on the door to get out pretty soon.
It sure is. So you'll fall asleep great, but then you have to wake up.
Our number, 860-275-7266. That's 860. I'll do it slower. A lot of people are calling up, though. 860-275-7266. Here's Daniel. This actually came up on our bicycling trip, so this will be interesting. Daniel in Newington. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. This is very timely for our family. Why, when you urinate a lot, do you sometimes get leg cramps?
First of all, that's assuming that everybody does, but which it may just be your entire family, and nobody else. But any thoughts on that?
Well, Daniel, thanks for calling. Question for you: what's coming first, the cramps or the urination?
Well, my wife and I both take diuretics, so it causes you to pee a lot.
And then after that.
And the leg cramps usually come in the evening.
I see. Okay. Well. The most simple explanation for that would be related to dehydration. So if you're urinating a lot and probably you're taking diuretics because one of your doctors feels they want to get you not dehydrated but not overhydrated, you might end up getting dehydrated that day. And especially if you've done some sort of exercise or sat still for many hours, your muscles are more likely to cramp with dehydration.
You know, this came up actually on this bike trip because, in fact, once again, people were biking in high heat. They were dehydrating. And so what were we being told by the non-medical degree possessing leaders of this bicycle tour is that we should be taking salt tablets. And then it turns out if you're in Germany, one of the places we were, they sell you magnesium tablets instead. But is any of that any good, or should you just kind of let the body do what it does and try to make sure you're hydrated?
Well, I think if you're doing a specialty bicycling trip in the mountains of Germany or Austria, I would just listen to whatever – your bike guide tells you.
Do what Wolfgang tells you to do.
Do what Wolfgang tells you to do, unless it's completely weird.
Okay.
But it does make sense. You know, if you're taking salt and water, you'll be able to retain that water in your circulatory system better for your muscles. That said, I would never advise salt therapy to the average person who wasn't doing something strenuous because that'll raise your blood pressure and can be deleterious to your health.
All right. This show is our salute to urine. So on the number, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Can you pee too much? Is there such a thing as peeing too much? I mean, if you're drinking a lot of people are walking around with water bottles all day long. And mm-hmm. I mean, is there anything wrong with that?
No, if you're peeing a lot because you're drinking a lot of water, then there's nothing wrong with that. And actually, it's probably good for you because you're able to flush out more toxins and excess minerals and salts and things like that. So, you know, all the people around who really care for our health, like trainers and massage therapists and people who are into making you feel good recommend drinking a lot of water, and that's the right thing to do. You can, however, pee too much in the setting where you're not drinking a lot, and those are medical conditions. One is diabetes, where the main presenting symptoms, at least back in the old days when we weren't testing everybody for their blood levels of sugar, used to be polydipsia, which is drinking a lot, and polyuria, which is peeing a lot. But there's an imbalance. And what happens there is you end up depleting your body's water, and then you're levels of sodium and other things go up too high, and that can be bad for you.
Let me ask you sort of generally. We're talking to Dr. Ryan Dorn. He's a urologist from Hartford Healthcare. In terms of sort of lifestyle overall, complete the following sentence. My patients would be less sick, and I would have more time to play Angry Birds in my office if people generally did dot, dot, dot.
Drank more water and ate less salt.
Yeah. It's really that?
Yeah, because a lot of my patients have kidney stones.
Mm-hmm.
And the two biggest factors that we've identified so far is just not enough water and then the high salt American diet.
Yeah.
And it's accounted for the big shift in kidney stones to a higher part of the population and also to a younger proportion of the population over the last 20 years.
We've had a little bit of that here in the WNPR offices now that I think of it. Let me just talk about pause on salt for a second there, too, because this is something I've been kind of interested in lately as well. And one of the things that that I read, and I'd love to get your feedback on this, is that if I just give you one specimen, that's going to be kind of a snapshot of how much salt I've had lately. But in order to sort of really get a sense of like how much salt I'm getting in my diet, at least one doctor whose work I've been reading says you really should almost have to collect 24 hours worth of urine to kind of get a sense of how much salt is in the person's diet or at least in their system. True or false? Yeah.
That is true. Yeah. I mean, if we check your blood level of salt, it's probably going to be normal because you probably have kidneys that are working to make sure the blood level stays normal. If we check one urine specimen, it could be because of whatever you ate that morning or just you didn't drink a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
So really the best way to figure out what's in somebody's urine is a 24-hour collection because that amplifies all those little particles that we look at to levels where we can really make distinctions about what's going on.
The other thing that I read is salt is hiding in a lot of things that where we don't expect it. now some of this could be completely bad information, but because we were all talking about this on the trip, somebody was saying that there's more salt in a McDonald's milkshake than there is in any of the other McDonald's products. And I did read from a much more reliable source than somebody on a bicycle that bread baked products often have a lot of salt in them, much more than we think they do.
Certainly do. Yeah. Pretty much anything that you'd get in a restaurant, unless it's specifically low salt, is probably heavily salted because it tastes good and it makes you come back and buy it again.
Mm-hmm.
So anything you eat at a restaurant, anything you take out, especially things like pizza and bread too. Anybody who's baked bread will tell you, I've heard because I've never baked bread, but that they do add a lot of salt to the bread.
All right, we've got a lot of calls coming in here, and let's just try one of them. Here's Fred in Brooklyn. Hi, Fred.
How you doing?
Good, you're on the air.
Good. I have a question for you. When I was a young child, I had to take sports physicals and I had to pee in a cup. And one time the doctor came back and started rambling on about too much protein in my pee, and I got scared and passed out. And ever since then, I've been afraid of having too much protein in my pee. And he said just to drink a lot of water, and now I try to pee clear every time I go to the bathroom. What does that actually mean?
Too much protein. I don't know if I would have passed out. I would have definitely passed out with the blue thing. But anyway, yeah, help him out on this.
Well, thanks for calling. I hope if I ramble on, you're not going to pass out while you're driving there. But, you know, the protein in the pee when you're a kid is usually concerning for something called nephrotic syndrome, and that just means your kidney filter is malfunctioning. It has too big of a hole in it, and you start to lose proteins, and that can be very serious. The fact that we're talking today and you seem like you're doing okay tells me that's probably not what happened, unless you left out a lot of details between then and now. So that's what you're looking at as a kid. We should know that whatever the doctor tested you with in the office is called a urine dipstick, and that's more of a screening test. And it's not really all that accurate, but it raises red flags so that people can do more specific tests later on. So these days, you know, if you came in and you had that test and it showed protein in your urine, it would depend on how much protein and your other medical problems, but you might want to see a nephrologist or just an internal medicine doctor just to make sure your kidneys are working fine.
I will say, by the way, just back to the thing we were talking about before, that for a different reason, for screening for a possible adrenal tumor, I did the 24-hour urine collection thing, and you have to keep like this big jug in your refrigerator for her. And it brings you much closer anyway to, and when you're all done and you're ready to bring it in, you know, you really kind of, the heft of it is, gives you kind of a sense of.
Were you proud when you plopped it down
on
the
table? I kind of was, actually. I kind of felt like I'd done a certain kind of marathon. All right, let me grab one more call here, and then we'll take a break. We're in the next segment, we'll continue to take your calls, your questions, a lot of you calling in, all guys, I'm noticing, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Also, in the next segment, Maggie's also going to talk a little bit about things that you can do that can strengthen certain muscles that affect all this. I guess that's the best way to put it. Here's Max in Guilford, though, with a question. Hi.
Oh, hi. I just have a quick one. It has to do kind of with sanitation, really. In urinating, if you have more than one stream of urine, let's say sometimes I get two or sometimes even three, what happens is, you know, only one stream will be able to hit the correct target, and the other stream, unfortunately, goes elsewhere. I'm wondering, is it possible? Is there anything that can be done about that?
You know, I felt as though at some point in this show there'd be a moment of too much information. But fortunately, we don't know Max, so it's not too much information about him. Yeah, you want to address the multiple stream question?
You know, Colin, it's funny. When I hear that story, it doesn't throw me at all. I hear that 10 times a day, you know, it is fairly common, unfortunately, for bathrooms all over America.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one thing that can cause that is a narrowing of your urethra. So in your penis, the tube that carries the urine out from your bladder sometimes can get a narrowing as you get older or as a result of previous inflammation or infection. And the end result of that is that you get that splaying of the stream. The other thing that can cause that is if you have a weak stream, which is because of an obstruction, like a big prostate, or your bladder just doesn't squeeze very well. And then it just doesn't come out in that nice, strong, like fire hose type stream, and that can spray more. So, yes, to answer your question, something can be done about it if it's because of either of those two things. And I would go see your urologist to have that evaluated.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here. This is our salute to urine. When we come back, we've got more phone calls, including some that were way out of the purview of Dr. Ryan Doran, urologist from Hartford Healthcare, but that doesn't mean we won't put them on the air. And Maggie Downey is here with us. She's ordering a personal euphoria Pilates.
If you gotta go, you gotta go through me. It's a privilege to be. Water's worth its weight in gold these days. No more bathrooms like in olden days.
When I was 19, I had a malignant tumor in my bladder, but it's funny, stay with me. Because I'm a hypochondriac. And I think the funniest thing that can happen to a hypochondriac is that you get cancer, because it confirms every fear you've ever had in your entire life. You're like, see? I told you. Remember last week when I was overtired and I thought I had rickets? I was probably right about that, too. There's going to be a lot of changes around here. It was less funny at the time. I remember I was driving home for Christmas break. I went to school in Washington, D.C., and about halfway home, I stopped at a rest stop to pee, and I don't mean to be graphic, this is just what happened. There was blood in my pee, which I knew could mean like five things, and three of them mean I die, and the other two aren't exactly a trip to the Bahamas either, and it was particularly disappointing, because sometimes when I'm on road trips alone, I'll have water drinking contests with myself to see how clear I can make my pee. Who's with me? And I'll drink all this water. I'll stop at a urinal. It'll be clear. I'll be like, bingo, you know. And so when it was red, I was like, I lost big time. And
all right, that's Mike Birbigli. He's fine now, but that's part of his monologue. I think it's from Sleepwalk With Me. He was on the show, and I told him that partly because of him and partly just because of my own nature, I started doing that whole contest with myself thing, too. Anyway, we're talking about urine today, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Dr. Ryan Doran is with us. He's a urologist from Hartford Healthcare. Maggie Downey is here. She's the owner of Personal Euphoria Pilates. She's going to talk a little bit right now about sort of muscular things that you can do that can affect how happy you are, I guess, with the way that you pee. In a little while, we'll also talk to Dinas Mikkel. He's somebody who's involved in the urine therapy community, people who believe that it's helpful to drink your own urine. And there are people calling up with lots of other things that don't really fall anywhere within the expertise of any of our guests. But that doesn't mean we won't put you on the air, because there are. I discovered this in researching our show. There's people who believe that urine can. It's like hemp. People believe it can do almost anything, and certainly you could probably make an entire city out of hemp and urine. 860-275-7266 is the number to call. Before we get back to some of the calls, Paul, Don, Mike, Liz, Scott, you're all on my mind right now. We will get to you. The phones are kind of full, but let's just quickly check in with Maggie about this, because one of the reasons that you wrote to me about this and planted the seed for this particular show was because of Kegels, which is something that you work on. Explain this whole Kegel thing.
Sure. Well, Kegels are it's the generic term for the muscles of your pelvic floor. It's named after an OBGYN from the 1950s who first developed tools for Kegel exercises. And the concept is generally you'll squeeze and release your Kegel muscles. So the Kegels, these pelvic floor muscles, run from your pubic bone to your tailbone and to your sits bones, and they help stabilize your pelvis. Basically, they're the only thing keeping a lot of your internal organs inside. They can attribute to low back pain, and they're the muscles you use to stop you from peeing, mm-hmm. or to stop you from defecating and to control that. They also affect orgasm. So there's a lot of fun things you can do with your Kegels. Both men and women have them, although a lot of men don't realize they do. But we all have the same muscles at the base of our pelvic floor. Women tend to have a lot more problems with their pelvic floor muscles.
Yeah. And now I'm just going to try to merge you two guys a little bit here, but I'll start with you, Maggie. I'm trying to think about how I can phrase this without revealing too much information about myself. But let's just say, generally speaking, as a man ages, one of the things he notices is that, generally speaking, the force of his urine is not what it used to be when he was a 13-year-old kid and could hit the wall 14 feet away or something like that, and that it kind of, and the end of the urination process is kind of a sad affair, as opposed to something with lots of gusto that can then be sort of cut off instantly. I realize this is not necessarily entirely a muscular problem, and Dr. Doran, in just a second, can talk about sort of why that starts to happen as we age. But I'm assuming Kegels could at least give you like a little, you'd be hitting off a better tee anyway in dealing with all this.
Right. Well, I mean, I wish I could pee 14 feet. That's pretty impressive, I think, that you ever had that. so you might be going for a standard.
Yeah. That it was never documented. I mean, sorry. The Guinness people have, refused to accept it.
I do think that it's more than just your Kegel muscles, but I do think it's involved. And I feel like lately some up-and-coming research is sort of giving Kegels a bad reputation, saying that, well, we don't work our muscles in isolation, so just to squeeze them is a problem. But the problem is, as we age, both men and women, particularly women who, when you start to go through menopause and you have all these hormone changes, our muscles generally get weaker. So if you're losing the feeling or the sensation, just to start to be able to squeeze them and find that muscle again is going to be helpful. And especially women, we do a lot of damage if we have children, if we've had a hysterectomy. Male and female athletes, you can get an overdeveloped Kegel, but you can also weaken your Kegel. So riding your bike is probably not the greatest thing for your Kegel. Yeah, I'm not saying don't ride a bike, have fun, it's life, but maybe do some Kegels. Some restorative Kegels,
yeah. So, let's say I wanted to do that right now. I mean, how would I do that? Can you describe, how would I mentally locate my Kegels?
Right. So I would take people through a couple of steps. If I asked you to engage your pelvic floor right now and you don't know what to do for that, I would say next time you go to the bathroom, stop midstream. Mm-hmm. And the muscle and sensation you feel to do that, those are your pelvic floor muscles. If you can't stop midstream, you should probably go see someone, your urologist, your OBGYN, and they can refer you. There are physical therapists who work on developing your pelvic floor muscles. But let's say you can do that. Mm-hmm. Then I would ask, are you more overdeveloped in the front or the back? Because a lot of people, especially we sit, or it's easy to squeeze your butt and make your butt do the work of your Kegel muscles. So the question would be, are you feeling engagement through the front of your pelvis, like all the way up to your pubic bone, maybe your lower abdominals? And if you're not, what I would say is to stand up, take your shoes off, lean forward so your weight is in your toes, but you're not going to fall forward. You can still balance. And do that same Kegel, engage the same muscles you felt when you stopped urinating midstream, you should feel more sensation in the front of your pelvis. If you don't, practice it. It's kind of like lifting an eyebrow or wiggling your ears. We can do that, but you might need to practice it. If you still can't find it, that's the time for maybe some biofeedback and a pelvic floor physical therapist. If you can, we can progress exercises into more functional movement from there.
It sounds like a lot. I didn't realize so much maintenance was required. But let me just go back to the thing that I was talking about before, but talk to Dr. Dorn about this. It is sort of true that as men age, you know, suddenly you're not the fire hose anymore, and it's all kind of dribbles to an unpleasant conclusion. What does this do to?
Well, in men, you know, troubles urinating are generally less because of the pelvic floor strength, but more because of a outlet obstruction, we call it. So big prostate is the easiest way to talk about it. So the prostate grows. It sits right in front of your bladder, kind of between your bladder and your penis. And so when you have to urinate, you have to pee through the prostate, basically. And as it gets bigger, then you end up with a blockage. And so that obstruction slows down your speed, and so you're not going to hit 14 feet anymore.
Right.
Maybe more like 4 feet, if that. The other thing that happens is as your bladder is working against that blockage over years, your bladder muscle becomes sort of disorganized and not angry because it probably doesn't have that emotion, but that's kind of how it ends up looking. And when it becomes disorganized like that and sort of overgrown, it doesn't generate that nice coordinated contraction that it did when you were a kid. So the bladder is squeezing not as well, and then your prostate is sort of in the way, and so you end up with the dribbling.
Yeah.
And then as far as cutting it off, dribbling leads to urine being stuck in your urethra. So you may feel like you're done, but it's not really all out yet. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you were young, it was just one big explosion out of there, and everything gets out at the same time.
All right. That was so much more than I wanted to know about myself or to have my listeners know about me. But that's all right. 860-275-7266 is the number to call. 860-275-7266. I trust all of you right now are out there engaging your kegels while we're having this conversation. We do have people calling in a lot of stuff. Some of it may be things that, as I say, are probably outside the purview of any of our guests. But here's Liz in Glastonbury. Hi, Liz.
Hi. People's Pharmacy in the Current this Sunday had a little article about an old Army trick to get rid of athlete's foot or odor is urine foot soaks. And I want to ask the urologist, is that true? Is there something in urine that kills fungus? And would we just collect it in a dish pan? This would help my daughter and husband, and we're just interested.
All right. He's not a foot doctor. He's not a fungus doctor. I don't know how much he knows about this.
Well, I've actually been asked this many times, and you know, would that there was something in urine that would kill fungal infections. I wouldn't have to deal with fungal urinary tract infections as often as I do.
Mm-hmm.
So people get bladder infections with fungus and they don't go away, you know, with just the urine. But perhaps it does. The one thing that could work in the urine is that it's a little bit acidic in most people, and that acid can perhaps kill the fungus. But I wouldn't bet the farm on doing it that way, and would recommend actually the pharmacologic treatments.
People have all kinds of, I mean, jellyfish stings is probably another thing you get asked about, right?
Right. So jellyfish stings, that's another famous one. There was a Friends episode back in the 90s where I think Joey had to pee on some one of his friends because they got stung by a jellyfish or vice versa. I don't remember exactly. It's been a while since I watched the rerun. But, you know, it's actually turning out to be more of a myth than anything else. Current recommendations are actually seawater before urine.
Mm-hmm.
So get out of the water, but then go back and get some seawater and put it on. And then vinegar is the best sort of over-the-counter remedy for that.
One of the big things, I was even sort of unaware of this particular canard, but I think Maggie brought it up in one of her emails. And in my reading about it, even including from some reliable sources, suggested it could actually make the whole thing, the sting worse. It could actually activate something else that's inside your sting and make your sting even worse. So we don't recommend that. Say no to peeing on jellyfish stings. Our number, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Let's try another one of these kind of outside the purview calls. We got a bunch of them. Hi, Dawn. This is Dawn from Willimantic. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I guess I'm calling more from an environmental standpoint. There's some good books out there. There's a little book called Liquid Gold, and talking about the different uses for food and fuel and dye and processing the nitrogen before it hits, you know, rivers and streams and stuff by putting it actually directly into your garden, whether it's flowers or food, and using it as a kind of a fertilizer. And
I don't know where she just went. Let me just sort of summarize too, because I know where she's going with this too. I wouldn't expect a urologist to know the answers to these questions, but there is, if you just sort of look out on the internet, which is an incredibly reliable source of information and speculation, there are all these kind of ideas about, even there's a video where these guys are explaining how urine can be used to charge your cell phone. There's some company working on these processes, and she's talking about an idea that's come up a couple of times, I think today from our callers, that it's a fertilizer and stuff like that. This isn't really necessarily your area of expertise, but I mean, does it intrigue you at all to think that there might be other uses for urine besides just flushing it down the toilet?
Well, sure. I think it's probably wasteful just to flush it down the toilet when you could pee on the soil around a tree, you know, in your yard that you want to grow without anybody being bothered by the whole idea. But honestly, I haven't studied this very much. Although the chemicals in urine, the compounds, the ammonia, all that stuff is the same that is in a lot of fertilizer. And I have been at one eco lodge where they encourage you to pee on the plants, and those plants looked very good.
All right.
What they left out was that those plants were later placed into your dinner, which is unfortunate.
So you should ask a lot of questions at an eco lodge.
Or not.
Or
just enjoy.
Exactly. No need to know. All right, we'll take a little break here. We are going to spend a little time talking about so-called urine therapy, but also if you have questions of a more conventional nature for Dr. Ryan Dorn from Hartford Healthcare or Maggie Downey, who's owner of Personal Euphoria Pilates and a Kegel expert, give us a call, 860-275-7266. And just start pissing outside, pissing outside. You don't know what you're missing until you start pissing outside. You know my favorite place.
This is bad. The show is totally losing energy. We have to do something to reverse the polarity. Do you guys have any ideas, any at all?
We'll cross the streams.
But you said crossing the streams was bad.
Cross the streams.
You're going to endanger us. You're going to endanger the listeners of this radio show.
Not necessarily. There's definitely a very slim chance we'll survive.
Then I love this plan. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our interns, Kristen Doerr and Andrew Gates, who's leaving us to become a roadie for the notorious B.I.G. Do you guys think we should tell him? No? Okay. The part of Bill Curry was played by Billy Carter. On tomorrow's show, The Nose ponders the week in culture. And now, back to Colin.
All right. You didn't think we could get through this show without talking about crossing streams, did you? You didn't think we had that level of maturity? I mean, everybody understands. All right. So one of the things I first started talking about this idea for the show, I was on this trip and there was a urologist on this bike trip I was just on. He was from Oklahoma City. And he said, well, if you're going to do that show, you got to talk about situations where people drink their urine. He was thinking more about Nathaniel Philbrick's book recently about the wreck of the Essex, one of the many occasions where people who are trying to survive something. This also comes up when people are trapped under earthquake rubble and stuff like that. They sometimes will drink their urine just as a way to have some kind of hydration. I think there's sort of a point of diminishing returns, but it does seem to get people through occasionally, maybe on the first go around or so, a time when they're sort of just desperate for some kind of liquid. But there's a whole other climate here. There's a whole other set of values here. And it really was, the first time I ever heard about it was in 1978 when the Prime Minister of India famously gave this interview on 60 Minutes where Dan Rather was unusually discomfited by the notion that this man drank his own urine for its health benefits. And it should be noted that Prime Minister of India lived to be 99 years old. Not necessarily because he drank his own urine, but I mean, you can't completely discount it either. So we were curious about that. We discovered, sort of doing a little bit more research, that there is something called called urine therapy, where people do believe in drinking their own urine and it having benefits for them. And then there's a so-called urine therapy community. There's a whole bunch of books out there about it. So we connected with Dinis Mikkel. He's a Chicago native. He's on the phone with us from Vienna, Austria. He's a composer, entrepreneur, and health advocate who has experience with urine therapy. Welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
Well, we're fine. So you've been listening to the rest of this show. Now we've kind of come to your part. And this is something that people have either heard of, maybe because they do yoga and they hear about Ayurvedic medicine or something like that, or they've never heard of before and can't believe anybody would be contemplating it. So maybe you can just begin. What's the basic idea here? Why would anybody drink his or her own urine?
Well, I mean, in terms of the basic idea, I don't think that the introduction, or I don't think that people believe. Maybe there are people that wind up developing some kind of belief in a practice, but it's a practice. It's a practical application of urine, and that happens all the time. It's happening in the pharmaceutical industry. Pharmaceutical products contain, either human urine derivatives or animal urine. Or animal urine derivatives. So, I mean, basically, I think that maybe people approach it from a perspective of belief. I certainly didn't. I basically wanted to resolve some health issues and found some books and decided I would give it a try, despite my complete and total revulsion just thinking about the idea.
So you were reading books about this, and there are some pretty well-known books, at least within the urine therapy community, well-known books out there about this, and I found them on Amazon. So you did this, and I don't know. I mean, do you drink your urine every day?
I've left three. Well, in terms of, it depends on what you mean by drink.
Okay.
Because I started with three drops of, it's called early morning, and I'm going to have to pay attention to my daughter for just a moment. I started with three drops in orange juice, and I nearly threw up when I even, just tried it. And obviously you can't taste three drops if you put it in orange juice or tea. So I wouldn't say that I drink it every day.
Mm-hmm.
I intentionally left 3 days out at one point. But basically I've been pretty consistent about some type of application of urine therapy for the last 8 or 9 years.
And in what way do you think it makes you feel better or makes you more healthy? I mean, do you in fact feel more healthy in a way that you can sort of describe?
Yes, actually I can. I had extremely severe allergies. I was allergic to cats and I was allergic to particular grasses and trees. I used to sleep with an air filter. I had allergy covers for my mattress and for my pillow. I used to break out in really bad sort of like bleeding rashes around cats, and I would get a pretty sort of, it kind of looked like a sunburn if I went to a hotel and I was exposed to the sort of harsh chemicals that they use to wash their sheets. And so, I was in so basically what happened is that I was actually looking to reduce a condition called tinnitus that I had come down with, which is ringing in the ears, which I feel I reduced in a different way. But I started trying the urine therapy. I didn't need to sleep with the air filter anymore. I started being able to go wherever I want to go.
Mm-hmm.
I started not being afraid of going out into particular types of natural settings where I thought I might come down with an allergic reaction. I spent the night at a farmhouse where when I woke up, a cat walked by.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even know. And one of my friends was also staying at that farmhouse. And she woke up and she was taking all her allergy medications and all that stuff. And I was like, wow, that used to be me. She didn't know that there were cats either.
Now you
walked right past me. So
you since then have gotten involved with this sort of urine therapy community. A lot of people sort of communicating with one another, telling their stories online. And you know, just even looking at some of the stories, people almost invest it with all kinds of panacea-like qualities that it really could be used to address any number of health concerns.
They do, and it's kind of. I think that that's a real detracting point. I think that if I didn't practice urine therapy, I would look at that very, very skeptically and approach it very scientifically. In other words, if I wanted to make some kind of a judgment, I would observe. I would use the scientific method to make conclusions and that are based in my own observations. Because the claims are very –
I mean, people say that it can be used as a cancer therapy. I mean, all really extreme kinds of things.
Everything's in there. You name it. There's information out there, and people say from cancer to AIDS to now I'm saying allergies, and of course those large claims come across as extremely unbelievable. So you know that's why. Also, I think that's why when you introduced me, you used the word belief. Mm-hmm. You know. And I can understand that you would see it from that perspective.
Yeah,
you know, it's just that you don't formulate a belief when you're practicing something. You don't, you know, it's not. I mean, I guess if you wanna talk about things that are unprovable, you know, you can say I believe in this God or this religion or that religion.
Yeah, I guess
I certainly don't approach this from sort of a standpoint of belief. I tried something and it worked.
Yeah, I guess in order to get me to drink my urine, if I had a specific medical condition, somebody would have to say to me, because urine has X in it, and X is very helpful, it's demonstrably helpful in addressing problem Y. If you drink your urine, it's going... So when I was asking you about your belief, what do you believe is happening? I guess I was sort of saying that. In other words, I wouldn't drink my own urine just kind of in a general hope that it would make me feel better. I might be persuaded to drink my own urine if I had syndrome X and I was told or I read some literature that suggested that urine was specifically useful for reason Y, because it contained this certain thing. But it sounds like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's what I was really asking you, though.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are a bunch of hypotheses about why urine therapy works or how and why urine therapy works. You've got, I mean, and now, I mean, for me, I just practice. I'm going to read this list. You know, it's not like I have this off the top of my head. But reabsorption and reuse of nutrients, reabsorption of hormones, reabsorption of enzymes, reabsorption of urea. This would be the fifth one, the immunological effect. The sixth potential hypothesis is bactericidal and virucidal effect. The seventh would be salt therapy. The eighth is the diuretic effect. The ninth is transmutation theory. And the tenth is a psychological effect. And so these are hypotheses why and how it works. I came up with another potential hypothesis, and I think I'd need to work on the name, but I'm calling it something like a systemological intelligence. In other words, that the human body is a system, the urine is a part of the system, and that we are an intelligent system. And the body will, you know, use what it needs. It will discard what it doesn't, and that the urine is a part of this immune system.
You should call it the Mikkel effect. I mean, it worked for this guy Kegel. I mean, just you know, name it after yourself. Hey, very quickly, we don't have a lot of time left. Dr. Ryan Dorn, I'm assuming, not to put you on the spot about this, this is sort of just not something that's part of mainstream science, right?
Right. No, I would never recommend the patients drink their own urine. I mean, that said, you know, like the testimonials, and I think if you really, really, really believe and you're taking 3 drops a day of your own urine, you're not going to probably hurt yourself at all.
Yeah. Although, you know, people think that urine is incredibly sterile, but my sense is it's sterile like when it's inside us. It can pretty easily get contaminated when it's outside us, right? That's why they make you, when you do the specimen, they make you sort of catch it in midstream and all that kind of stuff.
Well, that's more because as you excrete it, it can catch bacteria on the way out. But mm-hmm. the levels of bacteria that are pretty minimal. So it's sterile unless it's infected, which sounds, you know, flippant. But if you have a urine infection, it's not sterile.
All right.
So I would not recommend doing this, but, you know, mainly because my background's different.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have searched the literature just in preparation for the show. And the only peer-reviewed article I found was a case of urea therapy 50 years ago for patients with liver cancer. And it was 8 patients, and it was not impressive in its effect. and very few patients. So, you know, there's testimonials for all kinds of things, and not to discount people's experiences. But, you know, I think if you believe...
Right. We just wanted everybody to know it was out there. Anyway, thanks to Ryan Doran. Thanks to Maggie Downey. Thanks to Dinah Smickle. Thanks to you for listening, too. We'll be back tomorrow. We probably won't be talking about this, though.
Thank you, Carl.
I gotta pee, gotta pee real bad, I gotta pee, and it's driving me mad.
I'm Kyone Wolf. Lemonade, 5 cents. Lemonade, anybody? 5 cents for lemonade. No, it's really lemonade, you guys.